O mighty and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for the generations still to come. Amen.
Oath of Allegiance. 2. Confirmation of Minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on 20th November 2014.
May I find the minutes of correct?
Communications from the Chair. 4. Petitions. 5. Announcements. 6. Papers to be laid. 7. Reports of committees. 8. Answer to all questions. And start.
Mr. Speaker, before we start with the session, can I, before the House starts with business, first of all, I happen to congratulate BBC for an excellent fundraiser yesterday, which has seen them collect almost £100,000, and reflecting the generosity of this community, which is exemplified throughout the year. I think we'd be curious to start the session without congratulating you on the publication of your memoirs and your recollection of the things that happened here. I think it informs all of us and perhaps might bring some semblance of history to our debates through the course of today, given that it's no doubt fresh in our memories. And note that Ms. Eva Hammond is still not with us, and wish her a very speedy recovery and return to our group. Mr. Speaker, this morning, the ministers who will be answering questions will be answering in respect of the portfolios they held before the reshuffle in order to be of maximum assistance for the House. Otherwise, we'll be dealing only with ministers who've been holding portfolios for a week answering questions. So I think it would be helpful for the House to have the fuller answer that can be given by the minister who has been holding the portfolio for longer. And Mr. Speaker, finally, before we launch into our discussions and our debates at this time of year in particular, I think it would be remiss of the House not to want to reflect on what happened in the Peshawar province of Pakistan in the past 48 hours, which has seen 132 children die. At this time of year in particular, which is so characterized by children, I would invite the House to spend a moment of silence reflecting on that, and perhaps the words of the Band-Aid symbol which says, and you might thank all of them for the love.
We now start with question number 761 of 2004, the Honourable DJ Buffoon.
Mr.
speak in Irish, really, every few minutes I've mentioned the speaker's memoirs, which I'm reading to, and finally one of great interest, I think. Yesterday was, in fact, the 40th anniversary of a demonstration which was occurring outside this house, and I think it was on the day of the speaker's probably 30th birthday, when the supermarket, I think they were, threw a stone into this chamber and almost hit Mr. Easterlet from the opposition benches. I think it was, I think the cause of the demonstration has to do with character, I think I'm imagining. Mr. Speaker, if I could pose the question formally. Can the Minister for Inward Investment provide details of all EU funding provided since answering question number 359 of 2013 to include all applications made with details of whose applications were rejected?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
I will answer this question with Heaven's Security.
Question number 763, the Honourable Dean Davison.
Can the Minister for Business Development please provide details of which entities have applied for development aid, with details of the nature of the project and the amount of aid provided to each successful applicant since the successor?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer given to question 359 of 2013, there have been no applications for development aid. Since May 2013, the following ERDF funds have been provided. A-Series Electrical, £147,371.23. ANS Project Management Services, £5,662.41. Astute Investments Limited, £19,999.06. DC Lesser, £78,670.90. Depot Construction, £9,232.42. Everly Limited, £19,040.59. Gibraltar Tourist Board, two payments, £9,932.88,842. The Sports Publisher Authority, £174,636.46. Horatio Holding, £68,092.63. Jet Diner Limited, £19,917.57. Fox Bay Holdings Limited, £16,103.29. Technical Services Department, three payments, £197,237.40. £198,297.62. £1,467.33.24. The Gibraltar Laundry Services Limited, £12,699.70. The Atlantic Cafe Limited, £65,283. No application for EU funding has been rejected since answering question 359 of 2013. Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable the Minister have a total of the figures? I've very roughly calculated it, and I've made it completely off the wall at about 2.6, 2.7 million, perhaps slightly higher. But am I in the right way? I mean, I can do the other things later when I've got the information, particularly from Hansard, or I'll listen to it in the audio service provided by the Parliamentary website. But I wonder if you have that information that you have. I don't expect you to bring out this calculator and calculate it.
I haven't got the total, but I would say it's probably higher than the figure that he suggests at first glance.
Mr. Speaker, don't you have an explanation as to why it is that? I have no idea what I can't give an explanation myself as to why it is that there is such a difference. That there is such a difference
between the figure that he provided to me in answer to my original question, which was posed in May 2013, which covered the period December 2011 to May 2013, and this period from May 2013 to date, which is more or less the same period. I think the totality of the sum total of the grant given in respect to the first answer to the first question was just under £1 million, whilst this is possibly 3 times that, or very close to that. Do you have an explanation for that?
Well, this is demand driven, that is to say, the amount of money has to be spent in a certain period of time. And I think what tends to happen, and has always happened, is that when we're getting close to the period where we would lose the money if we don't spend it, if there aren't enough private sector entities in the pipeline, government projects tend to be put in to make sure that we don't finish up having to give money back. Quite apart from losing that money, it becomes more difficult to get more money the next time if you don't spend everything they gave you the last time.
I'm grateful for that. So, giving that explanation, Mr. Speaker, was money given back shortly after I asked the question in May 2013? I think I don't have the exact proof as to when the funding has to go out. So I don't have that information. But as I said before, as at May 2013, when the period covered was in the region of a year and a half, but the expenditure was about more or less a third of what has been expended more or less in the same period now. And I just wondered whether money was given back in the first tranche when he was in office. But I may be posing the question wrong because I'm not aware of what the period is.
Well, if it had happened, I would have been very angry, and I don't remember being very angry, so it can't have happened.
Mr. Speaker, I take this opportunity to ask the Honourable the Minister for Concerning this House a report which appeared in the Gibraltar Chronicle on the 16th of December, which reported on further funding from Europe in some total of £9 million, and it was expressed as being £1 million more than the current sum. Can you confirm that that is what Gibraltar is receiving?
I think the report that the Chronicle had was something that emanated from statements made in Brussels. We haven't yet had confirmation officially of the approval of the amount. So, you know, I'm not going to make a statement in Parliament on something that is based on a report in the Chronicle, which is based on a report in the press in Brussels. But I asked when that report came out, and I was told, we have not yet been told. The government has not yet been told that he's been given the amount that he was asking for, so the answer is, I cannot tell him what the amount is, because a report of the Chronicle is based on a report from the media in Brussels.
Mr. Speaker, again, not being aware of how these things work in practice, presumably from the answer that he's given, there is no prior negotiation between the Gibraltar government and the relevant EU department as to what funding Gibraltar could receive, and you simply wait and see what is given to you. Is that a correct exposition of how this thing works?
No, the negotiation is between the United Kingdom and the EU as to what the United Kingdom gets. What we get is something out of the United Kingdom allocation, which was first obtained, in fact, by Robert Moore when the DSP was in government, and it was the first time, because prior to that, the UK had argued in their own self-interest that because we didn't pay VAT, we were not entitled to access to the funding, which comes from VAT. But we actually were able to challenge that interpretation, which had been going on from 1972 until we were in government after 1988. And the EU said that it was still an internal matter. As far as they were concerned, you know, for example, if Spain has a situation where a Ceuta doesn't pay VAT, it doesn't mean that Spain cannot use EU funds in Ceuta. So we were able to establish but it was a matter for internal negotiations, other than the fact that we can only access the pool of funds that is not destined for areas of very high unemployment, for obvious reasons. So the level of funding that is available is broken down into chunks of regions based on the regional unemployment rate. And we are only eligible for the chunk that is for the places that have the least level of unemployment. And therefore, when we're looking at the United Kingdom, for example, there will be areas of the United Kingdom, for example, at one stage it was Northern Ireland, at another point in time it was the area around Liverpool where unemployment was like it is in Spain, for example, and there would be a category 3 and they would get a higher level of funding. We have to compete with the ones that have got the least level of funding. The negotiation is conducted by the unit that handles the distribution of this fund, and it takes place predominantly with London, but our representative goes with the London team also to deal with that.
Which representative would that be? Presumably, say, if it's a civil servant from within which department? Can you answer that question? Because that's an interesting way of saying it, because the Chronicle report quotes the relevant, I don't dare pronounce, by Karina Kotti, for the European Commissioner for Regional Policy, and actually she's quoted as referring to Gibraltar's specific needs, not just the UK, but she seems to be very conscious of what Gibraltar's small businesses' needs are. And it'd be interesting to learn, given the explanation you've just given, what precise involvement Gibraltar has as part of the UK delegation, if I can put it in those terms, in the negotiations.
Well, I imagine what this lady said was because it was a question from the Gibraltar Chronicle. If they had had the question from the area of the parties, they would have talked about the need for Andalusia. So it's not that, you know, we have heard in such high esteem by the Commission of the European Union, but that particularly causes our problem. We've got a unit which has always been there, at least it's started, which is in fact part of the Ministry for Enterprise and is in the budget, and it's a unit that is headed by a senior executive officer, and he's the one that has been doing it longer, I think he's been doing it from the beginning, he's been doing it all the time, and therefore he's the expert in the matter. And certainly he tells me that he hasn't had an official confirmation of the funding. So if he doesn't know, then I don't think I can be expected to know.
Question number 762, the Honourable T.J. Bassino.
Can the Minister for Inward Investment provide an update in relation to the development of the Nothing Pool site?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the government continues to be in discussion with a successful tender of the Nothing Pool site. However, it is still the case that the reprovision of the pool has to take place before access to the site is obtained.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the question which I posed back in October 2013, which is, I think, the second occasion I've asked questions in relation to this particular project, the Honourable the Minister for Inward Investment explained that if it really progressed from that stage, which is sort of the initial stage when he walked into office, to the point that it has now, in effect, been awarded to him, i.e. the applicant, and he is now in the planning process. Can he provide the information? I know this is public, I'm sure obviously it's publicly available, but can he advise the site whether the planning process element of the project is now complete, or whether things are going to be done in that regard?
Well, it's not the government planning process. The process of the person that was successful in the tender, I don't know. I mean, you know, it doesn't communicate to me how the planning process is going. I don't know how close it is to finishing it, or not finishing it, or within a breakthrough, but it's nearly over. But I know that in any event, this is part of the project Houston, where we have to reprovide the assets that the MOD lose in one area in another area. And as the member may be aware, one of the things that was changed after the 9th of December of 2011 was the nature of the status of the payment. So that we, for example, in the Improvement of the Island Fund, the reason why we have a sum of money there unspent is because that is money that has been obtained from the sale of MOD properties, which is ring-fenced and can only be used, as far as we are concerned, for the repositioning needs of the MOD. Otherwise, otherwise, it would then mean that the money would have been spent on something else, and we wouldn't then have the money to do what we required to do in order to get the relief of those sites. So the answer is that even if the planning process is finished, until the pool is provided, the guy can get on the job. But I am not aware, because it's not something that I'm involved in how much more he's got to do to get the necessary clearance for the project.
And Mr. Speaker, I asked the question as a supplementary on the last occasion. I'm not sure he answered it. Is the project still a hotel project? And you talked about the applicants who are being in the planning process, but clearly you must know, the government must know whether they exactly intend to do that.
Well, I don't deal with planning, but I'm not aware of any changes from what was intended. And as far as I'm concerned, the nature of the hotel may change, but it is still a hotel and a tourist project, because in fact the investor happens to be the person that brings the highest number of tourists in Volta. And part of the philosophy of the investment, as he has explained it to me, is that he wants to have his own hotel here because he believes he can bring more tourists, and therefore he would rather, have a vertical integration of the whole process, where he does the advertising in the United Kingdom, he organizes private tours, and he puts them in his own hotel here.
Question number 764, the Honourable DJ Athena.
Can the Minister for Employment provide details on a monthly basis of the registered unemployed since asking question number W266 of 2013?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, to my knowledge, eating disorders have had no effect on the level of unemployment.
Yes. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member is absolutely right. I have been in error in quoting the written question number. It should have been 226 and not 266. So perhaps we could answer the question which you made on Sunday as well. But I prefer to change the season to the jury for our second meeting.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have many quotes, but my reading is not amongst them. I read the question very carefully and the number very carefully, and I try to answer what I'm asked. But if you want to know what the answer is, if you have put the correct question and said 26, then the answer is, of course, one that we already know, because I gave him the answer in 26, which is that we continue with the policy introduced by the previous administration, of providing the figures quarterly.
Yes, and actually, I couldn't find the. Because I've asked this question on a written basis previously. And the answer came back that, as he's just given us verbally over the floor of the house. But, Mr. Speaker, the reason why I ask this question now orally is because the Honourable the Chief Minister made a reference to a particular figure in the course of his political party political broadcast of the latest unemployment figure. Now, it doesn't tally with the latest unemployment figure which I have, which is the last quarterly figure, which is the latest that I can possibly ask, that represents the figure at the latest quarter. But I think the Honourable Chief Minister referred to a figure of, I think it's something in the region of 261 or 281 as being the latest available, 269 as being the latest available figure. I assume that figure, one of it would be the last monthly figure. I can only assume that. And that's why I thought I was able, given that information has been provided to the public through a broadcast, that as a member of this opposition, I was able to ask that question quite freely in this House, and every member would be able to provide it across the floor of this House.
In fact, he shouldn't be asking the question because in relation to information that has already been put in the political broadcast and it's already in the public domain, and he's not supposed to be asking the question to obtain answers which have already been put in the public domain. But in fact, as the policy was defended previously, when it was questioned previously by members who were previously on that side, the position of the government then and the position of the government now, which continues to be the same, is that the government thinks that it is the correct policy and practice that the figures should be given on a quarterly basis because it moves out the movement up and down. And therefore, it's misleading to say there is a downward trend because of one day figure or an upward trend because of another day figure. And I think when this was first explained in Parliament by the Honourable Mr. Neto as far back as 1997, the argument was indeed that he used an example that there could be a vacancy for a particular job in a particular part of the private sector and an influx of people who were only there because they knew of the vacancy and they were interested in that vacancy and they were not really available in terms of being willing to look at other jobs, and when the vacancy was filled, those people would then disappear. So, in fact, if one were to give a particular snapshot of the figure for unemployment, that snapshot changes not just on a daily basis, but virtually on an hourly basis during the day. Because while I'm talking, there would be people who are registered and unemployed, and there would be terms of engagement that are being inputted. So the figure that was given as an indication of a direction in which we're going, and we hope that the final quarter figure, it's not guaranteed, but I'm hopeful that it will be around the 300 mark of the fund, which as a leader of the opposition said in his first debate with me in 2012, in his judgment would then need really that we got no unemployment because it's very difficult when you get to the 300 mark, and clearly the people who are easy to employ have been employed already. The ones who are more difficult to employ are the ones that are left when you start going below 300. That has always been the case, it continues to be the case. But we may not bring it down to 300, but that's my target for this quarter. And the figure will be available early in January.
It's not that, and I try and formulate it in a question. May I just sort of try and reset the memory? It's not like I said that there is zero unemployment. It's that the unemployment, except for 3 years in the early 1990s, the figure started in 1990. It's the Honourable Gentleman's government that started with the unemployment figures. For the first 3 years, of course, in the transition from an energy economy into a private economy, the figures were oscillating around the 700 to 800 figure. after that date, the figures have stayed stable always. Doesn't matter which government has been in power, it stayed stable between the 300 and the 500. That seems to indicate, not that there is zero unemployment, and I'm asking whether he agrees with this analysis, not that there is zero unemployment, but that 300 appears to be the baseline in terms of unemployment that always has existed in the economy going back to 1994.
Zero unemployment is zero. No one unemployed. I think it's impossible to achieve. But in fact, I think that is the correct interpretation of the statistics, that it ranges between a sort of maximum of 500 at any one given time and a minimum of 300. And the fluctuations are even bigger if you look at monthly figures, because you can have a particular month, for example, when there are a lot of people made redundant, or a particular month when for example, a gaming company comes in and takes on more people than would be a normal. But the movement within the labor market in the time that I've been there is a movement which is of the voluntary, which is quite high. The movement has been in the region of 2,400. And therefore, even though the official figure is around 500, we all know that it went much higher in 2012 when we came in, because there were a lot of people not registered, the people who were waiting to be put on the DTA and things like that. He himself acknowledged when he computed the figure as being much higher. They are no longer there, that is to say. The people who were there and recorded are now recorded as people in employment. And that is why the employment survey records a much higher figure. And if I can quote the greatest libertarian on this subject, he explained to us, I think it was in the budget of 2006, if my memory doesn't fail me, that really the labor force of Gibraltar could only be understood in terms of having people in employment and people in unemployment. And when I was arguing there was hidden unemployment, his argument was, oh, look, we've now exhausted the labor force of Gibraltar. There are no more Gibraltarians available, other than the 300 odd that are registered. And therefore, if we don't import plenty of workers, the economy will be capable of growing. Well, look, the reality is that if we add the unemployed, for example, for October, and the Gibraltarians in employment in October, we will find that since 2011, on that basis, the labor force has grown, adding those two. So clearly, they can't have appeared out of nowhere. They must have been somewhere, but they were not being recorded in the system.
Question number 765, the Honourable DJ Rahim.
Can the Minister for Training provide details of the number of assemblies currently working at both the construction trade and engineering trade training centres, together with details of courses for which they are qualified to attend?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
I will answer the question together with question 76, 766, 40 to 768.
Question number 756, the Honourable DJ Smith.
Can the Minister for Training provide a breakdown showing how many trainees are currently training for NDQs in both construction and engineering trades, inclusive of individual courses being followed and the qualifications to be obtained?
Question number 767, the Honourable DJ Smith.
Can the Minister for Training provide details of how many instructors are presently delivering training in respect of NDQs in both construction and engineering trades, showing details of the training facility at which they are based, and are delivering and indicating whether they are government employees or employees of specific government-owned companies.
Question number 768, the Honourable Dean Davidson.
Can the Minister for Training provide a breakdown with details showing how many trainees have attained MDQs in 2014 pertaining to their construction or engineering trades, inclusive of information relating to the individual courses and level of qualifications achieved?
I'm sorry, the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, there are currently 11 assessors working at both the construction and engineering training centers qualified to assess carpentry, plumbing, painting and decorating, wall and floor tiling, plastering, bleed laying, mechanical engineering, and fabrication and welding courses at levels 1 to 1-3. There are currently 74 trainees in the construction and engineering trade. The individual courses being followed are carpentry, bricklaying, plastering, wall and floor tiling, electrical installation, fabrication and welding, motor vehicle mechanics, and mechanical engineering. The qualifications to be obtained are City and Guild certificates at levels 1, 2, and 3. There are 11 instructors, 10 of whom are government employees personally delivering training in both construction and engineering. They are based at the Construction Training Center and Victor delivering courses at levels 1 and 2 in planning and levels 1, 2, and 3 in carpentry, painting and decorating, wall and floor tiling, plastering, bricklaying, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, fabrication and welding. 134 trainees have attained City and Guild levels 1, 2, or 3 in 2014. The individual courses followed to obtain these qualifications were carpentry, plumbing, bricklaying, painting and decorating, plastering, wall and floor tiling, fabrication and welding, electrical engineering, and mechanical engineering. All these trainees, as well as those still in training, have been partly financed by the European Social Fund, as has been the case in previous interviews.
Question number 769, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please provide a breakdown of where and how all the monies deposited in the Gibraltar Savings Bank have been invested and the rate of return on each of these investments as of the 30th of November 2014? Answer the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer questions 770 to 772.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please give a breakdown by bank and amount of that part of the aggregate 770? Can the Chief Minister please provide details of the value of the Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures or other debt security as at the 30th of November 2014? Question number 771, the Honourable D.A. Peter. Can the Chief Minister provide the staff with a breakdown by debenture issue of that part of the aggregate public debt which comprises government debentures as at the 30th of November 2014? Question number 772, the Honourable D.A. Peter. Can the Chief Minister please give a breakdown by bank and amount of that part of the aggregate public debt which comprises bank debt as at the 30th of November 2014? Answer the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, as
that the Federal November 2014 the aggregate public debt consisting of bank debt of Barclays Bank 150 million and NatWest Offshore Limited 50 million. Government debentures by majority vote were as follows: 2017 debentures 19,716,800 pounds. 1 month notice 232,997,300 pounds. The value of Gibraltar Savings Bank and other debt securities by maturity date was 1 month 29,013,000 pounds. 2015 debentures 43,864,300 pounds. 2016 22,985,600 pounds. 2017 169,687,400 pounds. 2018 164,314,100 pounds. 2019 debentures 113,018,700 pounds. Other debentures 13,293,559 pounds. Bonds 102,712,826 pounds. Deposit account 271,607,852 pounds. The average yield in respect of the different categories of investment vehicles held by the savings bank for the month of November are as follows. On call accounts with the Bank of England, the Crown Agent, and the Volta Bank have an average yield of around 0.51%. The Gibraltar Bank, the Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays Bank, National Westminster Bank, Jessica Bank, and Lloyds Bank. Floating rate notes quoted on the London Exchange on the London Stock Exchange have an average yield of 0.91%. The floating rate notes were issued by the following: European Investment Bank, International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, Netherlands Bank, KfW, Republic of Finland, Volkswagen Financial Services, Dexia, GE Capital UK, Westpac Securities, Australia and New Zealand Banking Group, Centrica PLC, ASB Finance Limited, Royal Bank of Canada, BG Energy Capital PLC, Suncorp Medway Limited, BMW Finance, and National Grid Gas PLC. Monthly income debentures with a 6% return and preference shares in credit finance with an average dividend of 5.6%. As previously explained, quoted stock and call accounts fluctuate marginally on a daily basis, and these fluctuations are not significant. I shall now, Mr. Speaker, hand over the savings bank statement listing the investment. I'm not creating a precedent, but since we are near Christmas and it's almost the same time, I didn't do it with my purpose.
Question number 714, the Honourable D.J. Rafima.
Can the Minister for Small Businesses state what the full cost of the government has been on the small business tax rate held in 2013 and 2014?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of the small business tax rate held in 2013 was 7,000.
£937.59. The cost of the Small Business Saturday held this year is expected to be in the region of £6,700. A question that we have, I think it's kind of overhanging from the question in the order paper. Is there any, out of interest, is there any empirical evidence which the government can sort of use to assess the success of this particular venture? I mean, certainly, as far as the last business strategy is concerned, and the attendant amount of people supported it, Main Street was using that day, and only later, but it was there, I think, because it coincides, I think, very usefully with a national holiday in Spain, the Constitution Day, I think it is, and also in Madalara, in the protection of Wednesday. It was distributed by members, in very large numbers, But is there any empirical evidence? And the reason why I ask this is because apparently in the UK there is, and just looking at the relevant Twitter account, they have published, how much is actually made on that particular day in the UK. And I just asked that question whether they have that information, or whether it's something that if it doesn't, whether it's something that can be looked into for the future.
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, to concur with the statements that the older gentleman has made in respect to the fact that the Main Street before Mr. Saturday was, in terms certainly of the number of people, the footfall and the volume up and down the street and the adjacent streets, in our view, very successful. The statement that you referred to in respect of the UK measurement of the success of their equivalent is only an estimate. It's not actually the way that I've read it. It's not actually a number quite recognized scientifically. It's more of an estimate of how they think the data spent. I don't have any prior statistics in the way that, for example, we'll be able to give enhanced statistics on the other visitors come to water, hotel occupancy, overnight stay. I don't exist that research in respect of this method. But I have asked, though, as umbrella organizations, the GFSB and the Chamber of Commerce, to please invest to me with the assessment of their individual members so that collectively we are able to ascertain the impact of the small business strategy. I did receive during the course of the day and after messages, not just from the GFSB, but also from individual traders who have told me that they have had the best day, that they have had the best day in the whole year. And I do recall that last year as well, there were some traders who said exactly the same thing. So, in our view, it is a success. The anecdotal evidence would suggest that it does have to have the missing element which was put to me at the beginning of term of office, which is people's entertainment. What brings the families down to Main Street, apart from the shopping element, why they all attend, is also the families are able to entertain themselves with the different entertainment that we were on. But I say, without empirical statistical data, the anecdotal evidence that was received, and I hope that will be confirmed by the GFSB in December, was that traders did extremely well on that day.
Question number 715, the Honourable DJ Rafini.
Can the Minister for the Port provide details of the final cost of the recent trip to Hong Kong?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by the Honourable Gentleman is set out in the schedule that I now hand to him.
Or you don't wish to come back supplement information. Do so now,
please. Can the Honourable the Father of the House provide me with the total aggregate public debt comprising government debentures rather than the breakdown? Does he have a figure there of the aggregate public debt comprising debentures?
here I gave him two figures, which is 1 month, 252 million. And here I can find a figure. Okay, sorry. 1 month notice, 232,797,300 pounds. And of the 217 debentures, which have not all been withdrawn or repaid, the last time on the Honourable Grand Office has acknowledged that the final figure will not be known until after the end of December. There is still 19,716,800 pounds. Of that outstanding, which will not be there in January. So the total of the two is about 250 million. 250 million.
Yes, yeah. So we see the reduction in the aggregate public debt comprised of government debentures. But am I right that effectively we will see an increase in that figure? Because the Gibraltar Savings Bank will then take out will increase the figure for government debentures, which at the moment stands at 200 million. That will probably go up closer to 300 million by the end of January, and therefore the aggregate public debt comprised of government debentures is likely to rise significantly above this figure of 251 once the exercise is done that we spoke about last month.
No, Mr. Figure, that is not correct. The figure that we had the previous time was about the Gibraltar Savings Bank had invested in £100 million of government debenture. The figure that I've given him in the list that he's got is now 200. That 200 million is part of the 232 million that is still in public debt, so it's already there. And therefore, the only thing that is likely to increase is the 19 million that is still outstanding under 2017. So what we are likely to get in January is another 20 million of debentures to repay the 19.7 million. And therefore, it would still be that we've got 200 out to the bank, and about 250 or 260, so it will be around the figure that we had before, which is 450 between the debentures and money. Effectively, what the government has effectively done is converted the government debentures, which with the exception of the 100 million, has been held by individuals, the government debentures issued to individuals, they've converted that into government debentures issued to the Gibraltar Savings Bank, but the gross public debt will remain at around 450,
460. I'm sure the question is beyond what the minister would have expected from me, because I think in the last session he said that he was quite brave to provide me with an estimate of the expected cost, which he had at about 28,000. So obviously the obvious question is why can you give an explanation as to why the total cost, which has been calculated by me, my honourable and friend Mr. Vieira, quickly here, is slightly in excess of 40,000 for the year.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the honourable gentleman is correct. The answer that I gave as an estimate was £28,000. In the first place, I am advised by my officials that the original answer that I gave to him in the House last month should in fact have read £32,000. £31,000 to cover for the £2 of 8 pence. That was the estimate that was made by the officials at the time. They gave me the incorrect information, so I'd like to rectify that
as to the Honourable Gentleman and for the record. And the increase relates to the following. I'll just walk into it and I can make a note of the difference. Following the schedule that I gave him. In respect of flight, the estimate would have been around 11,500. It actually came up to 12,200. So there's a slight increase there. Hotel accommodation, the estimate was around 4,500. It came out to around 5,900, also an increase. Transport was estimated at 650. It came in at 887.71. Food and drink, for some reason, was not estimated. It came in for the entire week at £1,817, with 33 pence. Miscellaneous travel was also not estimated. It came in at £51. Miscellaneous, which meant expenses of DNA, DPA, public liability insurance for the reception and logistic arrangement, was also not estimated and came in at £818. The venue rental was £2,500 estimated, but came in at £2,684. Reception was estimated at £4,091.86. It came in at £4,178. Vision photography, £7,579 estimated, and came in at £800. So the web agencies, I haven't missed yet. So the web agencies are not allowing me to confer with this colleague. I said him to some of the estimated figures which then increased, but on attending to some of the breakdown, the general answer is that it was an estimate and then the actual figure incurred always increased slightly up. I think I'm right in saying that, yes, it was slightly increased in all of them.
I'm thinking of my voice, but I represent the rural community. I am musically enjoying what's going on at this time of year. But from a marketing point of view, Mr. Speaker, could the Minister, and it doesn't necessarily arise from the answer to the question that he's given, but could the Honourable Minister provide us with a flavour of what the objectives, if there are any specific objectives that he can allude to, what part of the process of planning for this event and what it is expected or hoped that can be generated from what isn't a significant investment, but which, in the light of the objective that he might offer, may in fact be considered reasonable in the event.
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, to say that I thought that the £4,000, although I accept that it's not an insignificant amount, was money very well spent. It's not a delegation that has been comprised before to visit the Far East. I said to GBC that, in fact, in my view, the government has been missing a trick in not having had a trade delegation attend Hong Kong on shipping matters since we were left into office. It's the first time that any government has done it. I think it is a trade delegation that should definitely attend Hong Kong annually. And I'll tell them why. But during the course of 4 days that we were in Hong Kong, we met with 58 persons. Those 58 persons were divided into 19 round table meetings. Literally, on the last day, we were having our last meeting, getting ready to go off to the airport. And we met what were the top companies in terms of fleet management, fleet operators, fleet owners, and we learned a lot. For example, we learned that the Hong Kong register went from around 5 million tons to 91 million tons since 1997. Our tonnage is around 3.4 million tons, and it continues to go steadily every year, as the Honourable Gentleman knows. But clearly, there is a lot to learn from being able to transform single-digit growth into double-digit growth in the space of time that the Hong Kong flag did so. And there are lessons that we can learn, which I've advised my Honourable colleague, Minister Isler, who will now be responsible for maritime affairs. It was also saddening to me that almost every company, if not every single company that we met, in fact, does business at Gibraltar. They either come into the bunkers, or they use Gibraltar for crew changes, or the provision of stores, stairs, and light engineering work, and of course, by docking. So, in effect, Gibraltar, due to its strategic location, has enjoyed the business of the maritime trade from the Far East since time immemorial because of our location. So I'm convinced that now that we've put faces
to the people that run the port and the water maritime flag, that we will be able, in the same way that we've done with tourism, that by meeting people, we'll be able to increase the number of people coming to water to the UK, transport operators, increasing air routes, etc. By knowing us, they will know that they are now a phone call away to be able to service and to be able to attend to any of their needs. I have no doubt that now that my colleague Minister Isla will carry on the work that has been started, we will be able to tap what I do really consider to be an untapped mine of business with water in the maritime world. We've just come back, so I cannot tell you whether the result of meeting 58 people are yielding or translating into the needs of business, but I can definitely tell him that I'm extremely confident that it will do so. But £40,000, I would in fact, if I had to make an assessment, I would now remove £40,000 of other marketing efforts and invest within this. That's a confidence I am as important that we continue with these further negotiations for the Far East.
Mr. Speaker, the last point to make, and I do thank him for the very, very complete answers given and giving us the opportunity to hear his thoughts as to, in relation to this particular case. But in relation to yielding business, how can that be assessed? And I know that politicians, especially when you're on that side of the house and if you're an expert, you will use all manner of adjectives. To make it sound as positive as possible, and there may be two. But is there any way, and this sort of relates to the question after that, this is for businesses, of somehow empirically assessing that? And one of the thoughts that come to mind are whether you can conduct a survey by way of questions, asking the relevant stakeholders that we talked about at the last meeting I had, and asking this questions relating to this topic. Asking them whether they have indeed yielded, I think you can hear the word, the results arising from this. If not, can some thought be given to pursuing this as a possible venture?
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, to say that there is no collection of hard statistical data on the small business Saturday, clearly traders will be able to tell their umbrella organisations whether on that day they did more business. So, whereas there may not be a survey laid before Parliament as to whether small business that day had more people down those streets, certainly we will be able to receive from the umbrella organisations whether traders reported on that day more business than usual during the course of that month or indeed during the course of the year. So, no empirical statistics, but certainly there will be evidence to be able to relate to the Honourable Gentleman whether full business salary was successful. It will, in fact, be easier to tell the Honourable Gentleman whether the meetings that we held in Hong Kong have yielded results. Let me, for example, tell you that we met with Bonnie Bunker Oil Limited, which you know is a very big company. We met with Fleet Management Limited, which is also a very big company. The Warren Group, another giant of the maritime industry. So these are recognizable names. If those companies, the ships that they manage or that they operate, call out the door testing the local agents for bunkers, ferries, provisions, light repair work, crew changes, we will register that. So it is much more scientific in this respect. So during the course of the next 6 months, ask local agents what business, if any, has arrived from the 19 companies that the delegation met. If those companies have been calling out before, which most of them have, then we'll be able to compare whether as a result of those meetings, there's been an increase in traffic to the water following those meetings, and then we would be able to assess that for him more scientifically than the small business Saturday assessment. But I'm sure that my honourable and learned colleague Minister Isla will introduce processes that would be able to collate that information. I would believe to be able to advise the honourable members opposite. Yes,
ma'am. I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. But we have what is really a question asking for statistical information. The final cost of the trip, the final, because the House already had an indication of what the cost was.
I have allowed two supplementaries, one asking the minister whether he can make an assessment, and he answered that. Then Mr. Bottino comes in and asks if there are some empirical basis on which that can be done. And the minister answers, and now we are going further and further, departing from what was a purely statistical answer. Now I am going to allow the Honourable Mr. Isola to reply, and then that is it, because we are really taking the whole issue far beyond the ambit of the original question. Mr. Speaker, I think we've had a similar discussion in relation to the financial services in terms of how you can monitor or cost benefit the investments made in marketing. Very similar to the questions you've asked in respect of the Hong Kong visit. And as we've discussed, and I think we've agreed on various occasions, it's extremely difficult to monitor, but I can tell you the converse is if you don't go, you certainly won't get the benefits that you will if you do go, which I definitely see are difficult to assimilate. But I can tell you that, for example, if we wouldn't have gone to Bermuda, we wouldn't have had the business we've had from Bermuda. If we wouldn't have gone to New York, we wouldn't have had the investment we've had from New York in respect to the ILS business. And if you talk to, there is one instance where I went on a private visit to Holland with a group at that specific request of him to meet and support them. And I can tell you that 3 weeks after my visit, I had called from them saying many, many times we've landed a huge crunch as well specifically with that visit. So what I do know is if it wouldn't have gone, that wouldn't have happened. And so there are 2 issues for me. One is raising the profile of the board generally, telling people about the quality of what we do in the reputation and the importance we attach to it. And the second thing is directly meeting with people in the sector, talking to them about what we can do. And there is an awful long way to go before we actually get there in terms of explaining what Gibraltar can do. We had an accountant in Gibraltar a month ago, senior tax advisor to one of the large accounting firms, who didn't know, at least in the UK, who didn't know that you could passport financial services in Gibraltar. So in terms of what's happened over the last 20 years, my personal view is we failed. And we have an awful lot of work to do to tell people what can be done from Gibraltar. So in my view, the money is extremely well spent, and it's more than that. If you talk to the private sector, they will tell you it's absolutely vital that we continue this.
Next question. Question number 716, the Honourable DJ Rafini.
Prime Minister for Employment stated that what goals you have been given to achieve by the Chief Minister and Deputy Chief Minister, and he told BBC following the Cabinet reshuffle.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, in addition to the general duties of the Ministry of Employment, I have specifically been entrusted with the goal of continuing the extraordinarily successful work that the great Joe Bassano has done at the Ministry of Employment. It is no mean feat, Mr. Speaker, to have reduced unemployment from over 1,200 to 269 as of a week last Monday. It is no mean feat to have employed well over 681 more Gibraltarians in full-time employment in just 2 years of government up to October 2013, compared to less than half of that in the whole of the 16 years of the previous administration. That means that in 2 years, Joe Bassano did twice as much in terms of adding full-time Gibraltarians to the labour force as all the ministers of employment of the party offices in all of the 16 years in government. And that figure would be even higher once the results of the last employment survey are published, which will provide the figures correct for last October. What a great record for Joe, and what a dismal record for them, Mr. Speaker. So the Chief Minister and the Deputy Chief Minister have set me as a goal that I should ensure that I follow the example of success set by Joe and not the example of failure set by employment ministers of the party opposite. It is certainly not going to be easy to follow in the footsteps of the two giants of Gibraltar politics. But, Mr. Speaker, I do relish the challenge of living up to the very high standards set by Mr. Bassano at the Employment Ministry. In part, Mr. Speaker, I will also be working to design and implement programs for the continuing and professional development of the private sector and to develop skills programs of selected areas of the private sector in consultation with small and medium-sized businesses. I've also been tasked with modernizing the employment registration processes, I've employment and training board, and placing all statutory systems online. The Chief Minister and the Deputy Chief Minister also refused to prioritize the legislative reform to the Industrial Tribunal, which has already been commenced, but which is a work in progress at the moment, so we are committed to our finalized during this lifetime of Parliament. Mr. Speaker,
what a disgusting reply from the other minister. What a disgusting reply, because honestly, I really had high hope. Speaker, in the letter which I published in the Chronicle, only a few days ago, I did say that I hope that the honourable minister, who I know pretty well and I've got to know over the last few years, is a reasonable guy with an open mind, would be given sufficient autonomy to rethink their flagship policy called the Future Job Strategy. But it clearly doesn't seem to be the case. And I was going to ask him whether he could put pay to any rumours that, in fact, the Honourable Mr. Bossano, the previous incumbent in post, was, in fact, still pulling the strings in that particular department. And he was confirmed by his answer that that must be the case. Because I don't believe for one moment that that particular answer has not had a hand in drafting by the previous incumbent. Mr. Speaker, but I'm still asking this, with some trepidation, whether as part of those goals, or indeed his own personal goals, whether he would consider, as we have been honourable, the leader of the opposition did when he had dealt with my portfolio in the shadow capacity, and I have on many, many occasions, is whether the government should consider to shift away from the future job strategy. It has been criticized by us on many occasions for the reasons which are legion and they're all in record, but also, in fact, by the United Union and other bodies. So will you consider for one moment the possibility of shifting away from that particular policy and amending it to provide proper training and proper jobs for a youth and unemployed?
Question number 717. Question number 717, the Honourable SNPOs.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister of Transport say whether any consultants were contracted by the bus company for the purposes of assessing proposals received from terms of the new buses to the Bulk Bus Company?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 718 to 720. And 73 to 77.
Question number 718, the Honourable SNP Eric.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister of Transport say whether there any progress has been made identifying what works need to be carried out the Europa Road to support the work of the new buses and what this might cost?
Question number 719, the Honourable SNP Eric.
Can the Minister of Transport provide details in response of the full amount of advertising revenue invoiced and received by Big Publications Limited on a yearly basis for 2012, 2013 and the year 2014 to date for advertising on the buses broken down into the following categories, namely, back of the bus advertising, side of the bus advertising, bus stop advertising and any other forms of advertising sold by Big Publications?
Question number 720, the Honourable SNP Ellis.
Can the Minister for Transport say how many formal complaints the bus company has received from the public about the new buses?
Question number 723, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Can the Chief Minister please provide details of the cost of the taxpayer, the maintenance contract, the new buses,
including but not limited to the hourly rate charged by the entity undertaking the maintenance and the term of the contract.
Question number 724, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please state who has been awarded the contract for the maintenance of the new buses?
Question number 725, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please state the price tendered by each tender in respect of the contract for the new buses, A, by reference to the price per bus, and B, the overall contract price?
Question number 726, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Can the Chief Minister state how many entities tendered for the contract for the supply of the new buses?
Question number 727, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Can the government please state whether it is eliminated, estimated, I beg your pardon, the cost of reinforcing certain parts of the road system in Gibraltar in order to cope with the weight of the new buses, and if so, what is the estimated cost?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
I suggest that at the end of the answer, the opposition be facilitated copy of the answer before the end of question time. I think it will facilitate the conduct of business and supplementary arising from this number of questions.
Mr. Speaker, no consultants were contracted by the bus company for the purposes of assessing the tender proposal. As previously mentioned in my answer to question number 639 of 2014, all matters relating to bid publications, including revenues invoiced and received, are the subject of an internal audit that is currently ongoing. Once this audit has been completed, the government will be in a position to provide the relevant details. The records of the bus company show that no formal complaints have been received from the public regarding any buses. Negative comments have surfaced in local and social media. The bus company is still negotiating the maintenance contract with Bus-Daily Motors in order to maximise the value for the taxpayer. The prices tendered by unsuccessful tenderers in the procurement process is commercially incompetent and cannot be disclosed. The overall contract price of the awarded tender is, as I said in the previous answer to your question, $4,790,000. I report the Honourable Gentleman to question number 552 of last year and 125 of this year. As I explained then, a total of five companies were invited to tender. Out of these five, four submitted price bids, of which all four companies were found unsuitable for the water. All of the vendors were then invited to participate in the negotiated procedure as provided for under Regulation 4, Sub-Regulation 1 of the Procurement Public Conference Regulations 2012. Subsequently, three tenders were received, from which one did not submit any bid. Finally, two companies were left in the final assessment. In relation to the weight of the new buses, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the answer to question 62 of this year, while informed him of the position in respect of reinforcing certain parts of the road system. In this respect, Grainger Associates, a firm specialised geotechnical consultants, was engaged on the 4th of November of this year to carry out an assessment of the retaining walls which line the Eurasia Road. The investigations are currently ongoing and results of the findings are expected this month. Until the detailed investigation is concluded, it is not known whether any work might be required to strengthen the retaining walls along Eurasia Road. I'm grateful for the answer. In relation to question 717 and the answer that most of my things have been taken on, I asked the question in the context of information that has been brought to my attention in relation to the appointment of a consultant. And of course, that information may, in the context of the Honourable Minister of Business, be unrelated and maybe it's been mistaken related to the bus company. So in that respect, Mr. Speaker, I will certainly seek to explore it with the Minister behind the Speaker's chair
In relation to the answer that he gave to question 719 and the revenue generated by big publications, I note the answer that he gave at the last session and the one to them, and wonder whether perhaps the minister can give us an indication of how long this audit will take, and perhaps more helpfully tell the House whether the audit of the council requested, as he alluded to in the last session of Parliament, has now been received from the publication committee.
As the Honourable Gentleman is aware, that the bus company, apart from our meeting, the bus company manager has a board of directors. The board of directors have instructed that the audit be carried out, it's an internal investigation. They are feeling to that, I have explained to him, the audit has not yet been completed, and therefore we cannot provide him at this day. With the relevant details. I have not been told in my supplementary information by when we can expect. Oh, yes, I have. By mid January.
I must see this. Can the Honourable Minister say whether, and he will have seen, I suspect, the customer if you find. Big Publications Limited, which stated that they have surrendered the contract in September. Can the minister say whether he was aware of that fact, and if he was, why it's not a matter that was raised when he spoke last in November of this issue in the Council?
Mr. Speaker, that statement was a statement that was issued by a private company, was not issued, or neither did the government nor the bus company have any hand in writing that statement. I read it along with the entirety of the public. So I will limit myself to saying that we do not, the bus company, as I am advised, do not think that the statement issued in that respect, in those papers after specifically, or when the contract terminated, is accurate.
Is the minister able to say whether, given that Big Publications Limited had actually submitted the, and I quote the Honourable Minister at the time when it was discussed in the House a couple of years ago, in my meeting, had submitted the most sophisticated funding structure of all proposals at the time, including the one from the existing provider of the service, whether, given the sophisticated funding structure, he is concerned that the bus company will not have the benefit of receiving those funds which were proposed as part of the proposal estimate.
He intends me to throw it into the very purpose of the audit, which I will not do, because it's trying to be ongoing. But I did tell him in the last answer to his question in many terms that the difficulty has arisen because there is a difference as to the amount that is owing. So that I'm advised. But this is subject to the audit currently being conducted, so I cannot confirm it to him with any certainty that once the audit is completed, the amount that the bus company will receive in terms of revenue will be higher, clearly, than what the bus company has collected. But to say anything else, I'm giving him an indication of what I've been about, but to tell him anything else is to basically suggest or try to clairvoyantly predict what the audit will actually be. I can't do that for him because it's time to be conducted. But we have committed ourselves in return to tell him that once the audit is completed and the results are known, and we are committed to giving him the relevant details. And as the Honourable Gentleman will know, the bus company has the same interest in accruing all of the revenue that is owed to it, as the Honourable Gentleman has been making sure that that happens. So there is no divergence of intention on either side of the house.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm that Dennis Buckett is one of the four unsuccessful bidders for this particular tender?
Mr. Speaker, I am advised that the identity of the tenders are not disclosable. It is not that I wish to be helpful. It is simply that I am advised that the tender bids are commercial in confidence and that I cannot disclose those to them. If I could, I would.
Well, Mr. Speaker, let me tell you, I'll get straight down to the point and I'll ask you and tell him why the purpose of the question. You see, the opposition has information that one of the tenderers is Dennis Buckley, and that Dennis Buckley bid substantially lower for this particular contract than, in fact, Man Buffaloni, which was the successful tender. Therefore, in those circumstances, it is a matter of public interest, and it's a matter of the opposition's entitled to scrutiny. The figures that I've been provided is that the Man Buffaloni buses were awarded a contract, and the buses, their bid was £155,000 per bus, whereas the Dennis buses was £130,000 per bus. Now, the Honourable the Minister has also said in answer to my question that out of the five, the four that submitted bids, the unsuccessful ones, all four companies were found unsuitable for his offer. Well, that can't possibly be the case with Dennis, because Dennis are, of course, the suppliers of the blue buses. So that company can't possibly be unsuitable for Gibraltar. And it would be very surprising indeed, bearing in mind their experience, if they made a tender of buses that was unsuitable for this community.
Mr. Speaker, let me correct the Honourable Gentleman. The original tenders, they were all, the buses that they tendered for testing, they were all discarded because they were not suitable for the roads of Gibraltar. That is a question of fact. They brought in the buses, they were tested, and they were unsuitable and they were discarded by the team that were dealing with the procurement of the buses. All four original tenders, all of those buses had been discarded because of the unsuitability of the bus provided for testing for the water. I can correct him and tell you that was definitely the case. It's not correct what he said, as a matter of fact.
Right, so all four, including the Man Buffaloni buses, so all of them except for the Man Buffaloni buses were unsuitable.
Sorry, what I said is that I'm not revealing to him the identity of the companies that provided for buses for testing. What I'm telling him is that of all of those companies, of the four companies that provided the buses for testing, those four buses that were tested were found unsuitable. I have not, by answering in the terms that I have, accepted that they were either Man or Dennis. I'm just telling him that of the companies that provided those buses for testing, they were unsuitable.
Can I ask you whether out of those four, ultimately the successful tenderer, Man Buffaloni, we know that Man Buffaloni was a successful tenderer ultimately, whether Man Buffaloni was also one of the ones that were deemed that were submitting buses that were unsuitable for Gibraltar in those four that he's mentioned in answer to my question?
I'm going to reread the answer again because perhaps we missed this aspect of the answer. As I explained to the Honourable Gentleman, a total of five companies were invited to tender. Out of these five, four submitted price bids, of which all four companies were found suitable for the water roads. And then I add, all of the vendors, i.e., all of the companies that provided the buses for testing, were invited to participate in the negotiated procedure under the relevant regulation. Subsequently, three tenders were received from which one did not submit a new bid. In other words, by the end, we were left with two buses.
Is it the case that effectively the government has chosen
has allocated a tender which is higher to the taxpayer than a tender which it had, which is lower than Dennis buses, which are the current suppliers of the blue buses.
Mr. Speaker, I have already answered the question for the Honourable Gentleman, but yes, I have in the term that I'm allowed to answer the Honourable Gentleman in this house. But if his question to me is whether the taxpayer did not obtain value because the award was not given to a company that had to bid at a less cost, let me tell him that when contracts are considered by officials, it is not always the case, certainly my experience in the years, that it's not always the case that the company that has quoted the cheapest price gets the contract. Because obviously the board will consider many other factors. And therefore, even if the award was given to a company that had a higher price, it doesn't mean that it was the least competitive. I'll give you an example. The Dennis buses in 2004 cost whatever they did. And there was a maintenance contract that was meant to be £80,000 a year. He knows, since they've given the information to the Honourable Gentleman, that whereas those, I'm sure at the time, that board in particular considered that they were the best value for money because the unit staff, the cost was by the mic. And because the maintenance would be so much, in fact, there were certain years where the maintenance contract came up to almost half a million. I can also tell him that the Dennis buses were found to be unsuitable for Gibraltar's topography. I explain to him why. Only after 4 years of the buses doing the circuit, they really started to need serious maintenance work. So even if the bus of Dennis were to cost lower compared to the bus of another company, when you add in the repairs and the maintenance and the cost, which I provide to the Honourable Gentleman, in fact, it's not as cheap anymore. So, the Honourable Gentleman, I'm sure, appreciates that the tender process is more sophisticated than just unit A, unit B, unit A £5, unit B £10, unit A is cheaper, therefore unit A. Because when you add the other factors that I mentioned, not least the maintenance contract, of which we have the information, then it's not comparing apples with apples, comparing apples with pears. And the experience of the Dennis Dart buses in Gibraltar has been, with all due respect to the Dennis Dart company, not a very good one or successful to Gibraltar. Let me tell you that the only company, the only entity in Gibraltar that won when they were awarded the Dennis, where Dennis was awarded the contract, was the company that has the maintenance contract, because from £80,000 a year, they all of a sudden selling to £250,000 a year, over £300,000 a year, sometimes half a million a year. So I'm sure that you appreciate what I'm trying to tell him.
Mr. I'm sure that he appreciates too that I am entitled to scrutinize what he has said. I'm entitled to scrutinize his tender. And the answer that he's provided me and the depth of information that he's provided me prevents me from doing that. Because, of course, it is my job to scrutinize where the government is obtaining value for money. And if I am told that effectively there is the man Barcelona buses have cost per bus £155,000 per bus, whereas Dennis is bid at £130,000 per bus, and I'm giving the Honourable Gentleman an opportunity to rebut that if I've got my figures wrong. Then it is up to him, the onus is then on him to provide cogent reasons why they've chosen one over the other, not surmising macrobialism. I mean, what you're effectively doing is you're saying, well, because this could happen and this could happen, but I'm not interested in what could happen in hypothetical situations. What I want to do is to examine this particular tender to ensure that the government has obtained value for money. And why has Barcelona Man been awarded this particular contract when there was another bidder that was substantially cheaper? And may I add this, that the information that I have been provided is that in fact this particular contract, in relation to the buses, did not include a maintenance element, that there were other companies
but effectively we're also bidding for the in relation to the maintenance. But look, I may be wrong in relation to that, but you're not providing me with information so I can properly scrutinize this.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is being mischievous when he knows that the relation is wrong, and I've already started the answer by phrasing it in terms that I am advised that the unsuccessful bids or the unsuccessful tenders are completely incompetent and I cannot disclose them to him.
And Mr. Speaker, he is advised. Where does that advice come from?
From the procurement office.
Who?
From the procurement office. Mr. Speaker, simply to add that the Honourable Gentleman says that I've given out the papers, I'm not giving out the papers. The Democrat Party's right on our work in 2004. I have given them exact figures of what the maintenance contract costs. So we can add unit cost of the bus throughout the maintenance in a year and actually start working out how much it costs. And the famous speaker, I can't add anything else to the information I've already given them.
The actual bids, 155, 130,000, one with the other, a substantial amount, the difference. That is exclusive of maintenance. And my understanding is that in terms of the maintenance element of all this, that is being dealt with separately. And indeed, it must be dealt with separately because the answer that he's given me is that this contract has been allocated. But indeed, in relation to the maintenance aspect, there are still ongoing negotiations with Bassaroni. Not with Bassaroni man, but with Bassaroni in order to see whether the government can come to terms with Bassaroni in relation to the maintenance. So one is separate from the other. I am focusing on the cost of the actual budget. But let me ask him this. Does he know that Dennis Buckley has written to the government complaining about the allocation of this particular tender, and has the government responded at all to Dennis Buckley and the complaints they've made?
Mr. Speaker, I have not received, nor been cited with any correspondence from Dennis Buckley. So the answer is no, I've not received any correspondence from Dennis Buckley. The complaints that Mr. Speaker, I'm also telling you that in my experience as well over the past few years, when companies compete on the day that they tender, they ordinarily almost always complain. So it will not be a surprise to you at all.
Mr. Speaker, but the difference, of course, is that you may complain, but if at the end of the day yours was the cheaper bid, substantially cheaper bid, and your vessel had been used successfully in Gibraltar over the last 4 years, then you may have cause to complain. I mean, I really don't want to get into the merits of that. I wanted to examine why one tender has been awarded over the other tender, and obviously the Honourable the Minister has not been able to provide me with the answer. Is he satisfied, bearing in mind the criticisms of the Dennis Buckley that he has made in this House, is he satisfied, and bearing in mind the unfortunate history, ancient history, I should say, because this contract has obviously only recently been allocated, and the buses are only recently on the street. But is he satisfied, given the unfortunate recent history in relation to the man that the Reni buses, that this will be a significant improvement on the Reni buses? Yes.
The comprehensive answers that the Honourable Minister has provided.
Is the Honourable Minister able to say, and perhaps you may need notice of the question, because I do concede that I may venture as a few far into technical detail, and that the Minister may be notice of the question. But could you tell this House what feature of the man that is, or rather what features perhaps make the man that is so appropriate, so optimised for the topography in the way that he suggests will mean that they will be more reliable and require less maintenance moving forward?
Speaker, I'm sure that I've answered this question before to him on the reason on the engines, and so I don't have the information before me, but very technical question. But the
he has, in fact, and then come back to the House and
today and made precedent for that, and so on, we can continue. Okay. So, we now deal with question 728.
Question number 721, the Honourable J.J. Nettles.
Speaker, firstly, the answer to written question 172 of 2013 in June of this year, can the Minister for Environment say is a marine accident compliance officer has now completed the investigation of the oil pollution within the port, and if so, please provide Parliament with a copy of his or her report.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, yes, but following the preliminary analysis of the NATO, no full investigation was deemed necessary. As a result, there was no report to publish. The NATO did provide me with a preliminary report. Mr. Speaker, will the Honourable Minister please not proceed to provide a copy of the petition or that preliminary report? Mr. Speaker, if I may refer the Honourable Gentleman to the relevant legislation, which is the Gibraltar Merchant Shipping (Accident Reporting and Investigation) Regulation of 2012, it reads as follows. The NATO may, at his discretion, and to promulgate any lessons learned from time to time, publish collected short reports of accidents which have not been the subject of a report submitted under Regulation 18, which means to say a very serious marine accident. I ask the NATO, which has no given independence to the government, or the contracted by the government to investigate accidents and to investigate funding, I did specifically ask him whether he would be publishing a report on this incident. And he said to me as follows by email, 1303 yesterday. I do not consider this incident to be a major pollution incident, and the company have implemented the recommendations. Therefore, I do not propose to publish this report. I then was able to know I have no power to ask him to do anything. Mr. Speaker, in the answer provided by the Prime Minister, closing the legislation, he mentioned the aspect of lessons learned as a result of an accident. Could I ask the Honourable Minister what lessons have been learned and what, if any, actions taken to rectify or to acknowledge the implement of the lessons learned? Mr. Speaker, what I have told the Honourable Gentleman was that the NATO may, at his discretion, publish reports of accidents. It's entirely a matter for him to make sole discretion whether, guess what, I'm reading for a legal legislation and that's the advice of the Maritime Administrator. And I've already told him that the NATO has told me that it is not considered the incident to be a major pollution incident and that he has no intention to publish the report. Do you take it, therefore, that there is no lesson whatsoever from a situation where there was oil pollution very close to the west side of Gibraltar and therefore nothing to implement to try and avoid a repetition, a likely repetition in the future? Mr. Speaker, what I can tell him is that the reason why the maker has decided not to publish a report, apart from the fact that he says that he does not consider it to be a major pollution incident in reference to the relevant legislation. He said, and I quote him, and the company have implemented the recommendations. If he wants me to advise him on those recommendations, I am happy to ask the maker to get those out for me. And you can either ask me at the next session of the house, or I can write to him. I don't have those with me, but I can ask them for him if he so wishes. I'm grateful to see that. I mean, quite frankly, if you get the information and the things that happen to me, and I will ask you a question next month.
Can Mr. Speaker, I just go right to the Honourable Gentleman. Question number 722, the Honourable D.A. Keating.
and it was from the government who said what the cost of the literary festival was to the taxpayer. Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of the taxpayer of the Bank of Gibraltar International Literary Festival of this year is £251,891.
We now move to question number 728, the Honourable E.J. Hagan.
Mr. Speaker, so can the Minister for Sport provide details of any planned vacancies at the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority, together with details of when these vacancies will be advertised?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 729.
Question number 729, the Honourable E.J. Hagan.
Can the Minister for Sport provide details in respect of any vacancies which may have been filled at the Sports and Leisure Authority since the answer to question number 483 of 2014?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the vacancy for the full operative was advertised and applicants interviewed. The successful candidate started employment for the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority on the 1st of December 2014. The post left vacant by the current CEO remains the same as in my answer to 483 of 2014, and just to recall, the answer stated that we were looking that it would be going to come out imminently. I can now report that we are looking at the whole of the structure of the DSLA, and it might take more time than I said in my answer to the last question.
Mr. Speaker, would the Minister, seeing that from imminent we have now changed into looking at the whole structure, does he have any time frame that he was instructed the whoever is reassessing the whole establishment of the place to adhere to?
Mr. Speaker, I have asked how long this will take, and all the indications are that it will happen slightly before the end of the financial year, because the impact would be on estimates and things that have to be done for the budget.
Question number 730, the Honourable E.J. Hillis.
Can the Honourable provide details of all dates when the two building facilities adjacent to DSLA swimming pool have been closed to the public since the sufficient opening, inclusive of reasons why any closures were necessary?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the magnificent Gibraltar Bathing Pavilion, which has and will give our citizens a great deal of enjoyment and fulfill one of our magnificent commitments, was never closed to the public. On Sunday the 21st of September, access to the sea was restricted due to work being carried out to the second phase of the project.
Question number 731, the Honourable E.J. Hagan.
Can the Minister for Sport and Leisure provide details of all dates when either of the DSLA swimming pools have been closed for public use during the second financial year, inclusive of reasons why any closures were necessary?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the following are the dates when the GSLA swimming pools have been closed for public use during the present financial year, inclusive of reasons. Swimming pool, the 25-meter pool, was closed on the 22nd of July and reopened on the 22nd of September. The reason, closed for summer maintenance 9 days earlier than usual
due to the installation of new filters and major maintenance work. Schools for the elderly, disabled, and teaching were closed 3 times, of which they were on the 14th, 15th of October and reopened on the 16th of October, on the 24th, and the 23rd and 24th of October, reopened on the 27th, on the 18th and 22nd of November, and reopened on the 24th of November. On these 3 occasions, closure was due to the pool user incident involving human species. Both pools were closed on the 1st of December and reopened on the 2nd of December. This is due to the torrential downpour, the water levels rose, and to the extent that the sewage water was emerging through the drains inside the changing room.
The last time, or the last date the Minister survived is, I think, on the 1st of December, which is due to the heavy downpour and so on. Is this a new problem that has arisen because we are saying some system like that, or is this a recurring problem that has been ongoing for some time?
Mr. Speaker, this is a problem that has been there for a very long time, and we are now trying to deal with all the changing rooms within that pool for the simple reason that during the time of the Gibraltar Basin Pavilion was opened, and although there are facilities of changing rooms and toilets for that place, many users were using the pool to change and use the facilities there. And the complaint has always been the amount of smell that emanates from the drain. And it is to do with something when it was constructed that smell comes out from the drain. And in this case, it was water that was coming out from the drain. We are currently looking at a whole maintenance program there, which will hopefully alleviate this problem, which has been there for, like he said, a number of years now.
Question number 732, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
Can the Minister for Heritage provide details of all work, together with a breakdown of expected costs undertaken at any heritage-related site since the answer to question number 486 of 2014, stating by whom these works were carried out?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, there has no further work or payment. I hasten to add that there hasn't been any payment, so I think that there might be some payment coming in later on. But since this is the one that is protecting me, I'm sure that there will be payment coming. But from question 486, there hasn't been any payment made on any work.
Okay, I appreciate that, Mr. Speaker. If no payments have been made, and the Minister can provide information, I shall no doubt ask him again in a couple of months' time to see what's going to be happening.
Question number 743, the Honourable D.A. Stephen.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state what was the total cost of a mega concert?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of the Gibraltar Music Festival is currently currently at £778,867.74. This is £121,132.26 below the projected budget in the estimate of £900,000.
Is this fair figure that the Honourable Minister has provided me the final figure? Because the cost of the mega concert, the actual cost of the mega concert last year, I believe from the estimate, came in
at just over £1 million. So there's a substantial difference between this figure and what it cost previously. So is this the final figure, or are there still bills to come in which will then be added on to the 727,000?
Mr. Speaker, when he said last year that the expenditure was over £1 million, which didn't take into consideration with the revenue, so it might have cost it, but the total cost has to be balanced off from what the revenues are to the expenditure. But to answer his question specifically, we are expecting a few more invoices to come, but I would not expect this to make much more difference. And in fact, we are even getting some more revenue, which are owed to come in as well. So this is the figure as from when you ask the question. But it might vary, but the variation will be very, very small.
Question number 734, the Honourable J.J. Nettles.
The figure, given the complaints by citizens of delays in the blood department of St. Bernard Hospital, will the Minister for Health ask for a management review of staff resources in order to expedite such delays in country?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
The Minister is looking to implement a new appointment system within the first quarter of 2015. This will address the issue of delays. Patients required for blood tests by the GP, consultant, or other clinicians will be provided with an appointment for attending the phlebotomy clinic on a specific date and time, either at the primary care center or at St. Bernard. The current complement is one full-time senior donor carer, one full-time donor carer, and one full-time phlebotomy trained nursing assistant. This should be able to meet the service demands once the appointment system is in place.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for his reply. The reason why I actually asked this question was because a couple of weeks ago, actually doing some shopping in Morrison, two particular ladies approached me, two ladies that were regularly to the draft department, and they were quite annoyed at the delay of being attended there. And according to them, the delays were due to the fact that some members that have retired, and that particular position has not been occupied yet. So this is the reason why we got to my attention, this is the reason why I'm bringing it here to the Minister, and hence the reason why I've asked the person, or framed the person, that particular way, in terms of the management looking to that. But it seems to indicate that that is exactly what they're doing. Well, the appointment system might help make the appointment go more faster, but I'm not quite sure whether there is a need for the mountain things, a need for better recruitment there.
Mr. Speaker, no, we're satisfied with the main levels that we have in that department. And what happens is that because at the moment there isn't an appointment system, everybody turns up at 8 o'clock, and you can never tell how many people are going to turn up. And therefore, even though the nurses work extremely hard and they're extremely efficient, and nobody knows doubting that, and they take time, because it takes time to keep your blood from the patient. And if you come in a little bit later than others, and there are many patients on that particular patient, then clearly you will have to wait. This is why we are now going to be piloting an appointment system, and we will actually get a time, and that should be able to distribute the number of patients who are having their blood taken during the course of the morning, so that they know more or less what time they are due to arrive. So I think that that will make an improvement, and that's what we're going to be trying out early in the new year.
Question number 745, the Honourable J.J. Nettles.
Mr. Speaker, will the Minister for the Environment please say if it is the intention to amend the maintenance programme in the Alameda Botanic Gardens in order to replace all the broken wooden bathrooms and benches and refer to the pastures due to the amount of potholes constituting the safety hazard to visitors to the garden?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, the management of the gardens has submitted a proposal for the paving of the pathway, which the government is studying.
benches are routinely maintained and the number of new benches have been added recently.
I think I'm going to need to take issue on the question of the benches, because the benches I'm referring to in particular, and I think it's called Grand Parade Road, because we're beginning there. The buttons of the benches have been broken now for some time now, so those have not been replaced, have not been replaced in the last 12 months. That said, one would hope that it does happen, obviously, and the benches are up to scratch. In relation to the pathway, will the Honourable Minister please indicate to us whether it is likely for the programme to deficit in pathways in the Olympic Gardens, perhaps in this part of this financial year?
Okay, Mr. Speaker, clearly, if I had been asked that question a few years ago, I could have told him exactly which benches and how many buttons may have been missing, but obviously, that is not my day-to-day role now, but I take the point on the basis of the parade and I will inquire as to where they are in the routine program. And regarding the resurfacing of buses, this is clearly a problem because of the effect of two routes. In the years that I used to work within the gardens, we tried many different methods of resolving this. What we have received now is a proposal for resurfacing of most of the main pathways of the gardens. But I expect that major replacement program would not start this financial year, will start next financial year, but there would be routine filling in of holes that have happened in the past during the course of this financial year.
Question number 736, the Honourable J.J. Nettles.
Mr. Speaker, from the Minister for Environment says, when will the restricted areas closed to the public in Commonwealth Park be reopening?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, areas are routinely cordoned off in order to assist in the maintenance. This is totally at the discretion of the gardening staff.
Speaker, but my understanding is that there are some specific areas which have been cordoned off right from the beginning when we were first established, I think, in July of this year. In other words, the specific areas that have been cordoned off since July, probably June of this year, June, July of this year, and have not been reopened. When are those specific areas going to be reopened?
Speaker, this is probably the only parliament in the world where we discuss the testing of a few square meters of grass in a park, but I'm happy to assist the member opposite.
That is purely due to the nature of our parliament. We are a parliament with national affairs that is discussed and also those of a municipal character.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Apparently, it might also be because there's very little else to pick on, because they're doing such a good job. I accept your comment, of course, Mr. Speaker. The areas we're talking about are the mounds, which were particularly popular with children climbing up and rolling down. And therefore, they took more wear than the rest of the area. The area has been reseeded, but there have been problems in relation to pigeons eating the seeds and the seedlings, which is now being addressed because the area that covered until the grass is big enough. And also the fact that whenever those areas are cordoned off, children will once again, and that's what they're there for, go up and roll on them and so on. So they need to take more time than would normally be taken in an ordinary flat area of course in order to recover. But when the grass is ready to take, that is the discretion of the people there on the ground day to day. I've seen them recently. I often walk through there on my way between one office or the other, and I suspect say we'll need a few more weeks to get into the root system just then enough to take the trip. But this is, as I say, something which is routine maintenance in ever well-used survey.
Well, Mr. Speaker, first of all, in relation to the first comment that the Honourable Minister made, it seems to me that he seems to suggest that highlighting this particular issue are not that important. He doesn't say, therefore. So the political point I was going to make is that if that is the case, that is converting from an environmental to a politician has been shorter than envisaged. But keeping on the issue, Mr. Speaker, on these specific areas which have been cordoned off since June and continue to be cordoned off in June, can the Honourable Minister say whether it is a problem of wear and tear, despite the fact there has been almost 5 or 6 months where nobody has been testing in those particular areas, or whether it is in fact a problem of the soil underneath the ground?
Is that Andy? Okay. Mr. Speaker, I think this is the first personal attack across this house since the famous television house. Very well, Mr. Speaker. Yes, Mr. Speaker, my political abilities have been questioned, but that's for others to question, not for me. Mr. Speaker, this is due to wear and tear. It is normal that if you step on grass and you step on it a lot, it's going to wear. I have no information that it is due to the soil, because the soil is exactly the same on the mound as it is in the rest of the park, where the grass is growing in a good condition. There's no question of bedrock, there's gravel underneath. I don't think that there is another reason. I honestly think that it's due to the wear and tear on the grass.
Question number 737, the Honourable J.J. Nettles.
The Kenya Minister for Climate Change provide Parliament with a guiding strategy for combating climate change.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, the government's strategy for combating climate change is multifaceted and includes a combination of both top-down and bottom-up approaches. The Department of the Environment and the recently created Climate Change Task Force, chaired by the Deputy Chief Minister, have been actively addressing key aspects of the broader strategy during the course of the year. The strategy will be elaborated further in the revised Gibraltar Climate Change Programme that's currently being redrafted by the Department of the Environment. I can nevertheless inform the Honourable Member that the strategy is generally divided into four main overarching themes, which include: 1. Adapting to climate change by building Gibraltar's resilience. 2. Facilitating the transition towards a low carbon economy. 3. Improving our understanding of climate change science. And 4. Raising climate change awareness and changing consumer behavior through educational initiatives. And this follows the strategic approach adopted by the United Nations Environment Program for combating climate change.
Can the Minister indicate to the House when will the climate change strategy report will be published?
Because the climate change task force has been meeting virtually on a monthly basis for about a year. I said recently, but it's recently in relative terms. It is now close to completing its work. And I would think that within the next few months we will have a document completed.
Speaker, how does the Honourable Minister see his actual strategy, once he's finalised in the report, will be intertwined with the latest accord, the latest agreement, rather, as a result of the Lima Agreement, which I think was on this last Sunday, the 14th, at 1 a.m. in the morning, in relation to the emission that needs to be obtained by 2020?
Interesting, because depending who you hear reporting on the meeting of the parties in Lima, you get different impressions as to whether it was successful or not. The environmental lobby insists that it wasn't enough, and other people insist that it was. I think it's a major step forward. Now we're no longer discussing whether climate change is caused by man, but how we are going to tackle it. And this was certainly the impression that I got when I was fortunate enough to be at the United Nations General Assembly on climate change, conference on climate change. And we will respond to the agreement, and I would like to think that we will go beyond, because we have a potential in our small community of leading by example. It's been a tough job, because clearly, climate change wasn't in tune 3 years ago, and it's been hard work to push this forward. But I am confident that we will have a robust strategy which the Volta can be proud of, and which will be, in fact, among the best in the world.
We can just have one more final question, or supplementary question, on this side. Is the government, is the Minister for Environment confident that the Volta will be able to obtain the level of emissions agreed to by 2020?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 748, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Environment please say, the Continent Eco-Waste Power Limited has started building the buoys and its necessary infrastructure in order to commence producing electricity into our grid and provide Parliament with an update on this matter?
Honourable, the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, no, they have not. Eco-Waste Power Limited are currently involved in a tender process, I believe they're currently in Gibraltar, for the required engineering work to be done in Gibraltar. The Department of the Environment and the Gibraltar Electricity Authority are in contact with Eco-Waste Power Limited in order to monitor progress, and we expect work to commence on site next year. As I say, I believe they're currently in Gibraltar making preparations for the work to begin quite soon.
I'm grateful for that, but it seems to me that when the news actually came out in the newspaper Bloomberg in relation to this particular agreement, that they were talking then about everything being in place by the end of this year and starting to produce electricity at the beginning of next year. Could I ask the Minister why the delay, why the discrepancy between what the Minister just said against what came out in the Bloomberg article?
The Bloomberg article, I believe, was prepared by the company, and therefore this may have been their perception. Clearly, when you actually start a project, you begin to realize the things that you have to go through. Have to go through the planning process, which it did. There's their own tender process in sourcing the local firms that are going to be manufacturing equipment, which is clearly something that we welcome. So there are steps that need to be taken, but I'm not unduly worried at this stage that these delays are going to be significant, or rather that these delays mean that the project is not going to go forward. I'm confident at this point in time that there are genuine procedural delays that one comes across whenever one is embarking on any project, particularly one which is fairly new technology, certainly for Gibraltar.
Can I ask one just last supplemental question? Because within that article, after seeing the article, a statement that can be confusing, perhaps even contradictory, and it states
devoted funds to produce 50% of its energy from renewable sources of 2020. Having been formally rewarded, gives the impression that that is going to be the only source upon which the government is going to rely for producing these renewable sources of energy. Could the Honourable Minister perhaps clarify that this is not the be-all and end-all to the government's strategy?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker. We are developing a strategy which includes analysing other renewable sources of energy. I dare say we've already seen in a small way the introduction of some solar. That will now take off next year. And we are talking to people about other forms of marine energy, and we haven't decided other forms, such as the more modern wind generators, which are smaller and do not create a danger for migrating birds. And so we are looking at the whole range of renewable sources, and we're working out a strategy and trying to work out at what rate we have to introduce these and what percentage each is likely to take. Clearly, there are some pilot studies which we need to continue regarding marine current speed and wind energy and so on, but I can confirm that we are not putting all our eggs on equal weight basket.
Question number 739, the Honourable J.J. Nathan.
Speaker, can the Minister for Environment say how many individuals have been fined or cautioned for the illegal enticing or feeding of macaques contrary to the existing legislation, either inside or outside the upper of nature reserve, stating where, the date, nationality, amounts imposed, which entity imposed the fine, and whether some cases are awaiting to be heard in the court?
Mr. Speaker, the information requested is in the schedule that I now hand over.
Can I ask, given the information provided in the schedule, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 individuals of which they have been cautioned. Is there a policy with regard to cautioning as opposed to imposing a fine?
I think that in the early stages of introducing of the season ticket, for want of a better word, the decision was taken by the department that we would initially deal with these matters by way of caution, warning, informing people that this is something new, but that they would face the possibility of fines. And after that number of months, it was decided that there was a need to step up a little bit more, and that's why the first funding ticket itself was issued in November. So there was a strategy of implementing this reasonably in a step-by-step way.
And one final supplementary question, if the Honourable Minister can help me. Of the three bridges mentioned in the schedule, is it possible to know whether you're talking about British Gibraltarians or other bridges? What's in the back of my mind, basically, and trying to find out whether they are local people, or whether they're actually coming for the day. I don't know whether good information available.
Mr. Speaker, I don't have that information, but if you will remind me or get somebody to call my office, we will look that up, and I'm very happy to share that with you.
The only reason is because I'm trying to think whether there is a particular problem needs to be dealt with in the sense of being cruel or being local, and whether we have to create more awareness among the local population or more awareness within the schools at a particular point. That's the reason why I'm asking the supplementary question.
Question number 714, Honourable J.J. Nettles.
Can the Minister of Environment provide Parliament with an updated account of progress with regard to the construction of the sewage treatment plant and work to the other parts of the sewage system, given the timeline for this aspect of work to commence and finish?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, with regard to the construction of the sewage treatment plant, a numerous meetings have taken place between the joint venture company, namely Northumbrian Water and Modern Water, and Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar since they were granted preferred bidder status. The environmental impact assessment process has been initiated and the target date for completion of the plant is in 2016. Works to the other parts of the sewage system currently being carried out are the decision and CCTV survey of the Minister along Rosa Road. This is due for completion in early 2015. The decision and CCTV survey of the South Square along Main Street from the junction with Ben Lennon up to King Street, due for completion in early 2015, and the last phase of the Wellington Front flood alleviation scheme, due for completion also in early next year.
A great thing to speak up for that information, but can I ask the Honourable Minister in relation to the sewage treatment plan, because I didn't hear when it is envisaged that work will actually begin. I mean, you've given me the process leading to commencement, but not a commencement date or an approximate commencement date. And when you talk about the completion being in 2016, are we talking about sort of the beginning, the middle, or the end of 2016?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have an initiation date, but the discussions have included tweaking the technology. We are aware of the fact that we use a saltwater system, which is not used in many other parts, so the technology had to be tweaked, and discussions are, I am told, almost completed then, and then the program, the EIA has to be completed. So I would have said that it would be a few months before work actually starts, which probably would make the completion somewhere around the middle of 2016. But as we have seen with other projects, the exact start and finish date, particularly finish date, are always a little bit relative because of things that need to feasibly take place.
Question number 741, the Honourable J.J. Nathan.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Environment say if the online reporting facility alluded by the Honourable Minister in fact of the press is now operational and is going to provide a monthly account of the reports submitted broken down by category?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, yes, the reporting facility is operational. The Environmental Agency and the government launched the online application given viral in mid-November 2013. That's one of two. I'll mention the other one in a minute. The application was advertised in local media. Posters were also displayed in public buildings, schools, and St. Bernard Hospital. And the Environmental Agency also has permanent advertising in three of its vehicles. And I had the information breakdown, and unfortunately it was prepared for me as supplementary rather than as a schedule. But there aren't many, so I will go through them and I can give the Honourable Member a copy. There are only 11 reports that have been submitted through this one of feral cats, four of litter accumulation, two of housing defects, one of smell, two related to pest control, and one related to smoke and fumes. In addition, the Department of the Environment is currently working on a separate online reporting tool which has not yet been published. This refers to 6 months suit, and the department is currently working on the procedural document for each stakeholder involved in 6 months suit.
the UN Minister needed to protect the economy as a public for information.
Question number 742, the Honourable J.J. Nevin.
Speaker, can the Minister of Environment tell me the copy of the revised Environmental Action and Management Plan earmarked for September-October of 2014?
I'll the Honourable the Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, there are no plans to produce a revised version of the EIMP in September-October this year. The EIMP was updated in January 2013. There may have been confusion because having said what I believe I said in Parliament, I'm not sure whether it was at the time of my budget speech, was that there was going to be a seminar in September, October to review where we were on the EIMP. And that may have been the conclusion, rather than review the document itself. Because of other exigencies, that seminar didn't take place and is now scheduled to take place either at the end of January or the beginning of February. I just offer that by way of explanation because the way perhaps I said it may have given the impression that it was a document going to be reviewed rather than the implementation of the document.
There's no intention to revise the existing plan, and the existing plan was updated in 2013. Is that correct?
What I said was that I did not say that there was an intention to revise it in September, October, but to review progress on it. That will not happen early in the new year. Following that discussion, there may be an update of it. But I don't think I committed myself to updating it in September, October, but to review it. That's the distinction I'm trying to make.
Question number 743, the Honourable J.J. Nevin.
The Speaker, can the Minister of Environment provide time with a copy of the Water Waste Management Plan?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
The Speaker, the Water Waste Management Plan is available online. A copy will also be provided electronically to the Honourable Member today.
Question number 744, the Honourable J.J. Nevin.
Can the Minister of Environment provide a timeline for the commencement and completion of the municipal waste treatment plant?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, a precise timeline for the commencement and completion of the municipal waste treatment plant is not available at present. The plant is currently in the pre-qualifying questionnaire stage of the tender process. Invitations to tender are expected to be sent out to successful applicants shortly. I believe maybe as shortly as tomorrow. And the target date for completion is late 2015.
Question number 745, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, there is a question number 521 of 2014. Can the Minister for Housing provide updated details of how much has been written off in respect of unpaid rent pertaining to diamond rental homes so far in the financial year 2014-2015?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, no money has been written off so far in relation to 2014-2015.
Question number 746, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can government provide details for the extent of damage caused to rented homes, including of location, as a result of rainwater ingress during ongoing refurbishment work, since the also provided to question number 522 of 2014?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, during November and up to the 15th of December 2014, 32 flats have been affected by water injuries. As in my previous answer, I am advised that the immediate internal surface and windy surrounds have been affected, and the contractor has already undertaken effective repairs. The damage caused, inclusive of location, is as follows. Murray's Castle Estate, water penetration to ceiling is the cause, and there are 6 flats affected. In Laguna Estate, there are 7 flats affected by water penetration to the ceiling. At Laguna Estate, there are also 7 flats affected by water penetration to the windows. In Yasta Estate, there are 3 flats affected by water penetration to the ceiling. And for the 9 flats were affected by water penetration to the windows.
Question number 747, the Honourable E. J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide updated details in respect of all expenditure incurred since the answer to question number 524 of 2014 in respect of contracts awarded for making empty homes suitable for reallocation, stating to whom payments were made, how much has been paid, the number of residential homes pertaining to payment, as well as indicating if the project is contracted were for either repair work or cleaning services.
Mr. the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, we now hand the Honourable Member a schedule containing information requested. And the Honourable Gentleman could please note that all services contracted were for repairs and none were for cleaning.
Question number 748, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details on how many tenants required urgent decanting from their homes since the answer to question number 526 of 2014, indicating the reason why, the date when said decanting became necessary, and the date when the tenants were able to return to their homes?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer to question number 526, 6 persons have required detention from their homes as follows. Tenant 1, due to work, was detained on the 15th of October 2014 and returned home on the 12th of this month, that was December 2014. Tenant 2, result of school problems, they were detained on the 17th of October 2014 and were able to return to their flat on the 23rd. Of November 2014. Tenant number 3, as a result of work, was decanted on the 17th of October 2014 and they were able to return home on the 30th of November 2014. Fourth tenant, as a result of fire, was decanted on the 30th of October 2014. And yet there is no date set for the return to the working on that flat. Tenant number 5, as a result of problems with the roof, was decanted on the 17th of November 2014, and has yet no date set for the return. And finally, tenant number 6, was decanted as a result of repairs to the roof, and out on the 3rd of this month, of December 2014. And once again, there's no date set yet for the return.
there's also information leaked. The question said, you know, the Senate is calling urgent to come to one. Obviously, it's quite logical that we need the sewage, the fire, and the roof if something happened. But the minister on two particular occasions said that they were worse. Does he have any further information to this, you know, what type of work? Because it could be urgent rather than for this schedule.
Speaker, I don't have the specific information, but when their works, when their urgent work requires to a flat, and there is a question, kind of, the work's going to be done with the family within, then this reason for it, you can't know exactly what the reason was. I don't know. I'm aware of on certain occasions that the work could be due to humidity, and because of the removal was required, the removal of walls, or having to rebuild walls, the even things like rewiring. There's been another thing that's been a need for rewiring flats, and then we need to actually open up and function, has meant that the tenants have actually been defended. But I do not have the specific information that is going to need this question.
Is it even if there were any of these six urgent something, any of these in any way connected with the 32 flats affected for which the minister gave us information in question number 746, where I see some of them related to water penetration through ceilings, windows, and so on. Any of these six, in somehow or another, also included in those 32 for the services work?
Mr. Speaker, once again, I'm not sure if I have a question. I would suspect that not a risk, that they're different, but I would have to find out. I do not think that they are related to this. The time frame for return, you know, have been quite long, and I believe I did reply to the previous question, that I think most of the repairs have now been done, the flats that were affected through the water window.
I expect Mr. Speaker that I haven't sort of given all the consent of that. But think upon the Secretary's office of the Minister of Fire that any of these six do coincide with the Secretary there. But the Minister just kindly provide the information to me as and when he can, and we can then move on to the next question.
And then the question.
Question number 749, the Honourable E.J. Taylor.
Well, I have to answer provided to question number 532
of 2014.
Can the Minister for Housing provide revised and updated details of how many houses have already been assigned or allocated in respect of government's new co-ownership housing project, and how many still remain unsold given the room size composition in each state?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I will now hand the Honourable Member of Federal Continuing Information question.
I note that there has been further allocation. So, just so I can make a note here, can the Minister tell me as up to when is this going in? Because I've heard from some constituents that they were actually invited to GMP only earlier this week to be able to some of the as of yet unallocated homes. So, is this information correct as of yesterday or as of a few days ago? I know the Minister will have to collect information, but whether provided in the details should say as of when what date.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure the exact date, but they're still going down the series. and in fact, Yogi have 10 appointments left before Christmas.
Question number 750, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Speaker, so this is the answer given to written question number 182 of 2014. Can the Minister for Environment say if he has assessment to the current government fleet of buildings have now been completed in order to meet their manifesto commitment to have a fleet of vehicles powered by non-collision engines? And if so, will the Minister provide finally the copy of the report coupled with the government's action to fulfill the commitment by the time the next elections are called?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
The assessment of the government's fleet of vehicles has now been completed. The internal report is in the process of being considered to actually determine options on how best to meet the manifesto commitment given to have the transport fleet powered in so far as possible by non-collision engines.
The speaker, will the Honourable Minister allow the opposition to have a copy of the internal report?
No, Mr. Speaker, we do not publish the internal report.
But you could, of course, make an exception to the government policy and thus provide the report to the opposition. Is that a problem? This is a report prepared internally in order to enable the government to assess how it could comply with a manifesto commitment. It's a report Speaker was committed when he was in government. It's about the same fleet of vehicles. It wasn't his manifesto commitment to do it, so we have a manifesto commitment to deal with the fleet in a particular way, and this report is an internal report of the government. So there's no question of it being disclosed.
Question number 751, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, what is the term of the contract for the lease of a Tesla vehicle to the government, and what is the projected total cost of the taxpayer of that contract?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I would answer this question together with the question 752 and 753 of 2014.
Question number 752, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Now, Mr. Speaker, what is the total amount paid by the government to Bahraini Motors and or any other entity in respect of a Tesla vehicle used by the Chief Minister?
Question number 753, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
What is the cost of the taxpayer per month of a Tesla vehicle used by the Chief Minister?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government has entered into a financial agreement with IFC, the Bahraini Motors Finance Company, whereby IFC would finance the sum of £56,594, which is outstanding after the payment of an initial deposit of €30,000, with an interest only due of 3 years at a rate of 6%. This equates to a monthly interest of £282.97 per month. The deal includes an option to buy the vehicle at a price of £56,594 after 3 years. The monthly cost of buying the vehicle is almost zero. It can cost a pound or two to charge it.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister tell me there has been any need to come back to the maintenance of servicing on the vehicle since it was acquired? Mr. Speaker, I'm happy to help given the vehicle that I'm giving in. The vehicle is updated in service almost daily. It is connected by a 3G chip to the Tesla factory in California, and software updates and servicing is carried out in that way, which is really quite an incredible thing to see. It usually happens overnight as the vehicle is charging. Other than that, there's been no need for any of the any major overhaul of the vehicle. And there may be a need to repair a small part of the door, which is not working exactly as it should in the past people. But other than that, it's given a magnificent result.
And in terms of
miners and other moving parts within the on the vehicle, can it be affected remotely, clearly? Is the chief minister aware of, could the chief minister say whether it is in fact the one who will be conducting servicing as and when it is required in due course, in terms of the motors themselves and whatever may need servicing in that respect?
So they need to be Tesla are the suppliers. The maintenance of it is done by Tesla itself through Macedonia, and the same way as some other high end marks through their servicing through agents. Tires, etc., I don't think are particular for the vehicle. I think it's very few ones, as you know, like that. So those are available generally. And the weight of the vehicle is actually doesn't need changing of the tires very often, unless I mean it's actually quite light.
I would want to have a good idea of this as well. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the arrangement with I2, isn't the government's intention to acquire the vehicle at the end of the term?
Do you think there's nothing to suggest to the government at the moment that we shouldn't? And other government doesn't understand that the reason why the vehicle is not quite outright is that this is a new technology. I mean, they've tried and tested technology by the time that we were acquiring it, the vehicle was being marketed generally. But in order to ensure that we didn't end up with what might have been a dead battery, the honourable member of the Foyer, Jeremy Croxton, who is not a fan of the vehicle, you know, we're limited to use it, suggested that it might not be as good as the American market report suggested. So there might be an opportunity not to have to acquire it. But every indication at the moment is that the vehicle is working exactly as it needs to for the purposes of the needs of the chief minister of Gibraltar, and therefore the purpose of the intention is to proceed with the acquisition.
Or indeed, Mr. Speaker, as you know, we can not suggest because it is one of the popular vehicles. That notwithstanding, then, Mr. Speaker, is it then the case that IFC was effectively the entity taking the front on the vehicle when it was originally acquired by the government?
That's exactly right, Mr. Speaker. So in the event that the government were not to proceed, then IFC, that's the donor, as it says, the IFC would then take the vehicle back at the end of the 3-year period, and they would be the ones doing this marketing. I, for one, would certainly have been one ready to buy it at that stage. One Tesla vehicle, black in colour, slightly new, taken care of, much way put on the right back seat, but other than that, it's excellent working order.
Question number 754, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
The feedback. Can the Minister for Education provide details of how many students who are undergoing full-time education and enrolled in year 10 at the start of the academic year 2013 and 2014 have left full-time education before the commencement of the 2014-2015 academic year, providing a breakdown by educational establishment, date that is month of termination, and those of students at the time, together with reason for leaving is known.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 755 to 760 of 2014.
Question number 755, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Education provide details of how many year 11 students left full-time education during the academic year 2013-2014 before sitting GCSE examinations, providing a breakdown by educational establishment, age of students, date of termination, and reason for leaving is known?
Question number 750, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Education provide details of how many students receive full-time education in either years 10 or 11 or equivalent since the start of the 2014-2015 academic year, providing a breakdown by school year, educational establishment, and reason for termination is known?
Question number 757, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
when the Minister of Education provides updated details in respect of any changes that may have been in respect of students currently enrolled for post-GCSE education in years 12 and 13 for their equivalent, when compared with those enrolled at the start of the current academic year, together with reasons for termination is known.
Question number 758, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Education provide details in respect to the number of students broken down by gender who are repeating subjects pertaining to GCSE examinations which they sat for during the academic year 2013-2014, indicating at which educational establishment they are currently receiving revision tuition?
Question number 769, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Education provide details in respect to the number of pupils who sat advanced level and GCSE examinations or equivalent, broken down by gender and educational establishment where they received full-time education as at the end of academic year 2013-2014?
Question number 760, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Education provide details of how many students are presently enrolled for post-GCSE education in years 12 and 13 or equivalent for the academic year 2014-2015, broken down by gender and educational establishment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Speaker, the information requested is set out in the schedule, which I now hand to the Honourable Member.
It's a fairly lengthy schedule. I suggest that I give an opportunity to the Honourable Member to study it, and while he's doing so, perhaps we can proceed with a question to the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister, which is question 773, the Honourable Ben Bussin.
Question number 773, the Honourable DJ Bussin.
Can the Minister for Aviation state what steps are envisaged next in relation to the Single Sky Initiative?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. The government has been assured that the dossier on SES 2 Plus will not proceed to the next stage, which is the pressing of the European Parliament, and to the question of the applicability to the vote has been resolved. The matter therefore remains to the European Council.
I'm grateful for the reply, Mr. Speaker. But is there any further information you can share with us as to what the expected timetable is because of the matter now with the European Council? As I understand it, basically we are in the status quo as we were previously, which is that the air liberalisation measures, post the God of our cause, will apply to Gibraltar. And that the new initiative, especially which they wanted to exclude Gibraltar, is not going to be proceeding. Can you provide any indication as to what, what the European Council's next steps are likely to do?
This very much depends on what the presidency, the Italian presidency, wants to push this or not. At the moment, the position of the UK is that the inclusion of the voter is a red line. This could go to a qualified majority vote, in which case, anything could happen. It would be up to the UK to try and convince the other member states to support them and to vote us in this particular issue. The UK assures us that the Italian presidency will not proceed with the matter until it's been resolved. The council has not taken a decision on whether they can fix it. It's violent text is constructed in brackets. So really it's a question of whether to see what the presidency seems to do. And I said the next day, once the council approves the text in its entirety, including the votes on the poll, then it's going to have negotiations between the council and the parliament. That's the next day. That's to say, we're not pursuing the terms that we will not be pursuing to until the vote of which we've been cleared up in the country itself. There is a matter for qualifying the vote of which we've been voting.
Uh, given that it is a qualified majority, majority vote, the honourable chief minister will no doubt recognise that therein, in many respects, lies the danger with the United Kingdom, because although the UK has taken a very robust position in relation to it, something which the opposition obviously supports, it is within the realms of possibilities that there could be adverse. If that analysis which I'm making sort of on my feet now, the result of the answer is just given. Correct.
Yes, that is an option. And I think you could go for vote and the UK could be voted. It's not something that we're told is not likely to happen because the Italian presidency has now been back. And we see the Foreign Secretary called up to the Italian counterpart to make the point. So really, it's a question of waiting to see what it is that the presidency seems to do. So if the UK has made the position clear to them, and we now need to wait and see what the next step will be. What we're told is that they will not proceed onto that next step between the discussion of the Parliament and through this matter of the new world. So the UK has said that and said publicly very clearly that if the Catholic Civil Time happens to be excluded from it, that they would, that legal action is not true to the UK. Yeah.
Yes, in relation to that, just looking at exactly how robust the position of the United Kingdom is in relation to this, have you been able to discuss the United Kingdom as Plan B? In other words, if there is a vote and it goes against Gibraltar, have the United Kingdom government said to the Gibraltar government, look, in those circumstances, we feel so strongly about this that we will then take legal proceedings in the European Court of Justice in order to defend the Gibraltar's position and challenge the Gibraltar's decision?
Yes, I think in the public statement that the UK has made, I think it was the UK Minister for Transport, who is present in the council meeting, and in other public statements that have been made, legal action has not been ruled out. So what they're saying is, if this happens and the voice has excluded, then the UK is contemplating taking the issue to it.
I understand that there's a nuance, there's an important distinction. You don't rule something, simply because you don't rule something out, you're not effectively ruling it in either. How confident is the government that the United Kingdom, if we do get to the stage where it is outvoted by a qualified majority, that it really will stick to its guns and it will take legal proceedings, because effectively that's the only way in which at that stage we can challenge the vote of the proceedings?
The members asking me to accept an opinion, something which hasn't happened, we'll see where the trend is coming from. But certainly the indications that we've had throughout on the ESCDC is never been the particular one that's running. That's come up when they're in the pipeline. Is that for the UK, this is a red line issue. And we've had that. We saw it from the Minister for Transport the other day in the Council, and we've seen it also from the Minister for the and others. So the UK, this is a fundamental red line issue, and it's very prepared to contemplate every option.
Bear in mind that there is an election in the United Kingdom in May of next year, and that could lead to a change in government. Is this something that has also been discussed with Labour opposition in the United Kingdom, for us to say what its position is going to be in relation to this? This is obviously very important to debate.
So in the contract we have with members of different parties in the UK, and indeed in the Foreign Affairs Committee report published recently, I think the compromise in the first part is different.
Question number 774, the Honourable DJ Rufino.
Can the Deputy Chief Minister state how many projects are still being considered for the east side projects, with details of the entities which remain to be considered, as well as the nature of each of those projects?
Answer the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
The answer was put out in press release in the press release date to the 3rd of December 2013.
Mr. Speaker, the answer, I suppose, to the extent of the numbers of projects which are still being considered. I think the amendment first, but of course there could have been a change since the press release was issued, was six. Obviously, by the answers given, I must take it that it remains the same. Now, can you give me details of the other information which I'm seeking in the press? For example, the entities, the names of the entities which are remain to be considered, and if you can't give those, but at least the nature of the project, because I don't think that will set out in the press release.
The government announced that we are dealing with 17 entities that express an interest in these foreign projects. There are now six left. Those six will come and join into the presentation to the government in a more detailed presentation as to what it is that they propose. Some of them are for the one plot, some of them are only for part of the plot. And then when we announced the advertised expressions of interest, that came to notice. In the aspect that we explained really what we were looking at, which was a marina, leisure activity, hotels, commercial and residential, both high-end and affordable. So that mix is a different entity that put forward to the government.
Is he able to give me details of the entities which remain? I can give answer that formally.
So the government needs to get that information as being confidential at this stage, given the nature of the process.
Speaker, am I right to say that the government's preferred way ahead in relation to this is to have one bid for the entire site rather than have a situation where you're selling off parts of the plot to different people, which then will create a situation where perhaps the whole scheme will not be harmonious in relation to one part in relation to the other?
The one of the government is open to both options. It is under the West Side definition, and then the plot was sold to different developers for different landings. So really, we're open to both of these things. Either to pass them as a plot or to sell them as a plot.
In relation to today's bidders, the bid in relation to just simply part of the plot. As part of it. Are they in relation to housing or are they in relation to a marina? And can you give me some information in relation to that? I assume that it's probably going to be housing, either affordable or luxury housing. Probably the latter, but if you can provide me some information.
The member will forgive me for not elaborating at this stage because by the amount of information, and I might say this in the discussion with the diplomacy.
And go, Mr. Hill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If I arrive, I must record my gratitude to the Minister for Education for the comprehensive breakdown of the details. It's quite complete. May I, just for consultation purposes, Mr. Speaker, in respect of question number 758, I was asking. On the paper of which educational establishment any student could be receiving revision tuition in respect of any GCSE exams they have to repeat that they engage as part of the district at the end of the office of any year. And I have figures for both sides and West Side. There's nothing reported there in respect of the college. Am I right then in assuming in coming to the conclusion that the college does not offer any revision tuition at all to any student they have enrolled in the book to allow them to repeat any subject? At the stage of last year's GCSE exams? As I understand it, the PEEP programs are conducted by both State Side and West Side. Honourable members were before that when we came to government, there was a program conducted by West Side, but not by State Side, and it was suggested that that was unfair. We changed that, and we made it clear that State Side itself would offer a program. So for boys, there was a program at Bayside, and for girls, there was a program at Westside. It can combine possibly with other programs in the college. But anybody that wants to do the repeat program for GCSE, if it's a boy, they will do it at Westside, and if it's a girl, they will do it in Westside. Yes, I think I, but it's quite crazy. I even praise the minister for having brought to effect that faith has always been offered as a key court and so on. Yes, but the way the fight has been questioned, if you say that there are 34 boys enrolled in a repeat program at Bayside and 17 girls in a repeat program at Westside, but my question does go a bit beyond that. My question doesn't say how many are enrolled in that repeat year. My question says, well, the right reason is the number of students broken down by gender who are repeating subjects. Therefore, there could be a student who's undergoing 3 and maybe even 4 AS levels, but yet the school, as always happens in my day, is able to provide, for example, someone wishing to enter teacher training. Mr. Speaker, my business is now, it is now compulsory that you hold GCSE classes, grades A to C, at English, Spanish, and also science subjects. So you could have a very able student, very good language, for example, yet a good mathematics is not his focus, and therefore the school, college, based on the website, could actually offer, you know, that student opportunity. Otherwise, the student loses out, you know, could end up with 3 or 4 A stars at their level, and yet is missing GCSE mathematics and is unable to follow teacher training program. So perhaps I've not been able to explain the wider scope of my question. I wasn't just seeking information on the repeating.
I understand what the Honourable Member is saying. This has clearly been interpreted as being the repeat program which is available in Bayside and in Westside. I do not know whether there are any other students other than those engaged in the repeat program who are actually repeating any subject at all, but I will find out the information that the Honourable Member has.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, just to help to complete my whole picture. May I, on a happy note, say here, Mr. Speaker, looking at, because it's come to a schedule, I know viewers and listeners to the media may not have been able to grasp some of the details. Mr. Speaker, the girls seem to be doing far better than the boys, and there's a greater number of them proceeding on to post-GCSE education, so that could be a reflection in the future that perhaps instead of only having 2 female members of this House of Parliament, we have far greater female representation in this House, in the terms of the good work carried out by the education in this country.
I will now respond to 3 2,000. There is only one question for 3 o'clock. Is it not possible to take this question today?
There are two bills as well.
But can't we do the bills? Mr. Speaker, if the issue is going to be one question at 3 o'clock, look, I'm prepared to withdraw the question, ask it again in January. If we can do the 2 bills, which are quite short now.
The leader of the House wanted to talk about this question at 3 o'clock and then to the bills at 3 o'clock on the basis that there was a question on the order paper. If there isn't going to be a question on the order paper, we could tell the bills now there is no problem because we were responsible for the bills.
Mr. Speaker, to come back at 3 o'clock for one question, I will withdraw the question and if necessary ask it again in January. I don't think it really makes sense for us to come back.
Can I understand the point that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition is making? My own personal preference would be to stay on and to think conclude the business of the House. But it could well be that the Chief Minister, who I understand is not within the precincts of Parliament at the moment, may have something that he might wish to add this afternoon. If we conclude our business now before lunch, we are effectively precluding the Chief Minister, effectively precluding him from taking part in the rest of the business of the House. I don't think in his absence it might not be the right thing to do. Let me put it that way.
We'll
recess for 5 minutes.
I am informed that the Leader of the House would wish the House to recess this afternoon at 3. Really would like to be here.
before the House is advanced to the House of Resources to the President.